So we're going to go through biblical examples of governance. The way I want to kick this off is this. The church's understanding of personal, spiritual transformation and our understanding of the timing and purpose of the resurrection revolve around governance. You might, you know, you've probably thought about it. Other people wonder, you know, well, why would God call some people now but not everybody? Why is there a first resurrection and a second resurrection? Why? And we talk about this all the time. And it's all about governance. Because you are called now to be part of the first resurrection, not just so that you might be saved and have the opportunity for eternal life, but you're called now so that you might participate in what God has in store for governance, for establishing just and godly governance in this, not just on this planet, but in this world. And that is the gospel, the coming kingdom of God, your role in it. There's no reason to call you now and instead of later unless you're part of God's plan for governance. So governance is a big part of the gospel message. It's a big part of why we do what we do. It really plays into everything that we talk about. This present calling of God is about preparation for governance in the coming kingdom. It's not just about your personal salvation. Now, in the previous messages that I just referenced, we covered a couple of things. We covered some questions. One, is governance even necessary? I mean, why can't we just float around in the universe like benevolent clouds? Maybe we bump into one another, but we just, you know, everything's groovy, man, and there's no governance. Well, okay, is governance necessary? I went through this in the message. The answer is yes. Yes, it is. Non-governance is anarchy, folks. And anarchy is not what God has in store. It's really not what we want. Now, the second question, or the second topic that I covered, so this is a past sermon, human beings are designed to govern. You are designed to govern and to be governed. You make a whole lot more sense when there's governance, okay, and when you're part of it. Now today, this next part, we're going to explore God's guidance on how attitude, character, and ethics drive governance. Not the structure of governance, but the spiritual principles behind governance are what really matter. And ethics, when you talk about ethics, it's a little pet peeve of mine. Ethics is really why we do what we do. Not what we do, but why we do what we do. And God's very focused on that, and we're going to go through that by reviewing government systems at work among the people of God from the very earliest of times, through all the way up to, but not including, the inauguration of the church, which we went through at Pentecost. So we're going to go right up to that. We're not going to go into that. We're going to look at the past, okay? So that's a bit of a preview. Where are we headed today, right? The gist of what we're looking at is that the history of God's people is one of externals constantly changing. We went through Samuel together, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and we looked at what happened in Israel, and there was a lot of change. Things changed all the time. Things are always changing. On the contrast, though, the internal, the spiritual things, they remain the same. They don't change. And that's part of what we're going to look at as we look at some of the changes that Israel experienced. Now, you might think, well, what does this got to do with me? How does this matter? History, blah, blah, don't care. Well, look, this kind of stuff even has an application on a congregational level, right? Such as when you get a new pastor. That's change, isn't it? Things are going to change. Now, some people like things just the way they are, and that's okay. And some desperately want things to be different. And that's okay too. I don't take it personally. I just, I have my way of doing things, and someone else will come in and they'll have a different way of doing things. The change itself is neither good nor bad. What determines good or bad in a situation like that are the attitudes, the moral guidelines, and the goals. Some things change. Some things must not change. Now, the Old Testament record of governance is one of change. We're going to go through some of that. It is planting, it is overturning, it is replanting. But it's also about things that never do change. So with that clue on how it might apply to you, we're going to go through a few things. So I said we'd go way back, ancient times, way back. So if you go way back into human history, if you go way back into biblical history, you kind of actually find the same thing. Our first example of human governing structures among the people of God is the family of Abraham. A family structure under God. Okay? That's the very first thing we see. And the family, well, what is the family? The family is a group of people that band together for mutual protection and reproduction. And that puts us on the same page with, the evolutionary type people, the people who like to talk about, well, we all descended from mollusks or whatever. Yeah, the family is a basic biological survival unit. We're okay with that. That's what Abraham's family was doing. They helped one another to survive. But as God's people, and as God's people today, we are not driven by mere survival. We are not just about where can we get our next meal, how can we get ahead of the other person, how can we survive? I mean, look, don't get me wrong. We want to be fed, we want to survive, we want to thrive. That is not what drives us forward as people of God. So here you've got the family of Abraham, a biological survival unit, and in some ways they're just like the people all around them. And everybody else in the land, Canaan, they were biological survival units as well, tribes of people just trying to survive, But what made the family of Abraham unique, and they were unlike the people around them, was because they were God's people driven by God's word, his guidance, and they were seeking his will. Go with me to Genesis 18, way back. And, there's a whole lot of information about Abraham. Sure, we're just going to jump in this one sequence here. This is where Abraham is actually pleading for Sodom, where God is going to destroy Sodom because they're bad, bad, bad. And he asks, Abraham, what do you think? Right? That's what he basically says. What do you think, Abraham? And Abraham says, well, that just seems not very fair, God. What if there's good people in Sodom? You're not going to kill the good and the bad. And so, God says, well, that's interesting to hear you say that, Abraham, blah, blah, blah. And, he kind of, it's a very, very telling scene about, God is checking Abraham out. Okay, so and I think I said I would read chapter 18, verse 18 and 19. So with all this going on, and God's checking out Abraham, kind of, and he says this in verse 18, Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, though he's just a family now, and all the nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. So the difference with Abraham's little band was not structural. They were basically set up the same way as all the other tribes around them, the people around them. Structurally, the patriarch, I don't know what people were doing, but they looked probably just the same as all the people around them, except for the difference of spiritual direction, guidance, and so forth. And in this way, you know, they were separate and distinct from the world around them, even though they organized themselves, they sort of governed themselves, they set themselves up as a social unit along the same pattern as the world all around them. Okay? And that's a theme that we're going to see all through scriptures. And, you know, we even see it in the church. We adopt organizational patterns same as the world around us. What makes us different? Not the structure. No, it's the people. It's what we do, what we think, how we treat one another, and so forth. So we have the family structure under God, basic biological survival unit, in common with the rest of the world. Okay, the next, what happens is we move to a new kind of structure, all right? A national structure. Right? God spoke a little bit about it here. You know, Abraham will surely become a great nation. They weren't at the time. But time passes, and the family of Israel grew into a large population, just as God said it would. And God delivered this population of people from slavery in Egypt. And he formed them into a nation. More than just a family, they were a nation. And here they were, after 430 years of abject slavery, they were basically untrained and totally unprepared to govern themselves. And they were a blank slate that way. And God would take this blank slate and he would write on them some very important lessons. Now, God established his sovereignty over them. He was their king, their God. And when he started to develop them as a nation, the first thing he did was he gave them standards of behavior, not an outline of government, but standards of conduct, as well as ethical motivations, attitudes, and so forth. Now, among the people of Israel, there were the beginnings of practical governing administration. It just has to be. People really can't get along with each other unless there is some sort of governance, some sort of authority. And we see that administration in the person of Moses. Here's this guy, Moses. Now, some might say, oh yeah, okay, Moses, you know, they have one guy in charge, so why don't we use that same God-given paradigm for our, you know, how we organize things? Where's our Moses? One person in charge of the whole shebang. But while God's standards were written in stone, commandments, later the statutes and judgments, the practical application of leadership and governance, I mean, how they actually run things, is not written in stone. It's not even written into the words of Scripture. It's not a command from God. And they are subject to change. Even while Moses is still alive, things change. The way they organize things change. So the paradigm of Moses is even one of change. The nation grew very big, and Moses was just one guy. Moses could not personally manage this huge mass of people, you know, a million or millions, we don't know. That's just too much for one guy. I have a hard enough time with about 120 people. And I think the U.S. military maxes out command at 150. That's the most number of people that you can actually kind of manage directly. It's very difficult to manage a million people. And Moses was reeling under the strain. He was saying, oh, help! So there were some changes made even while Moses is around. Now let's take a look at them by going to Exodus 18. Exodus 18, verse 15 through 27 is what I want to pluck out here. Moses is talking with his father-in-law, Jethro. And Moses answered him, and he says, because the people come to me and they seek God's will, Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions. And Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You can't handle it alone. Listen to me now, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. But select capable men from among all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. In simple cases, they can decide themselves." Now, kind of like the Supreme Court, you know. "That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, if God agrees to this, you will be able to stand the strain, and all those people will go home satisfied." So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, and they served as judges for the people at all times. And the difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Okay. Jethro proposes a revised judicial system that delegates responsibilities. This is not coming from God. This is coming from Uncle Jethro. And Jethro says, you know, here's my advice, and you know, take it to God, and if God agrees, if he so commands, then it'll work out for you. So there's no indication that God inspired Jethro to say this stuff. What Jethro is doing is just, putting his own personal opinion and experience out there, which is good. It's realistic. It's practical organizational change, right? Suggested by a pagan priest of Midian. He was a priest of Midian. Midian would later be one of the great foes of Israel. But Jethro was a pagan priest of Midian. So, folks, what I'm getting at is this. Here are some practical things that God's people could adopt from without, from outside. Just because someone outside the church thinks of something doesn't mean we can't say, you know, that's a good idea. We're going to do that too. We can do that, and we do. If we don't have to have every idea ourselves, and we don't. So practical ideas can come from without. We seek God's will, of course. We want to see if God approves that. But really what matters is that they must be guided by the standards, God's standards of morality, ethics, motives, which we receive from him. So here, Jethro's advice was, you want men who are able, who are reverent, who are honest, who are not greedy. That's great advice. Good advice. Now go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 1. And we're going to read the same thing again, but there's a different twist on it here, okay? So here they are. This is about 40 years later. They're going into the land. Moses is reminding them of stuff. How'd we get here? What led us to this momentous time? Why are we standing here at the edge of the desert after 40 years? So picking it up in verse 9 through 18. "At that time, I, Moses, said to you, 'You are too heavy a burden for me to carry alone. The Lord your God has increased your number so that today you are as numerous as the stars in the sky. May the Lord, the God of your ancestors, increase you 1,000 times and bless you as he has promised. But how can I bear your problems and your burdens and your disputes all by myself? Choose some wise, understanding, and respected men from each of your tribes, and I will set them over you.' And you answered me, 'What you propose is good.'" Okay. "So I took the leading men of your tribes, wise and respected men, and appointed them to have authority over you as commanders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, as tribal officials. And I charged your judges at that time, 'Hear the disputes between your people and judge fairly. whether the case is between two Israelites or between an Israelite and a foreigner residing among you, do not show partiality in judging. Hear both small and great alike. Do not be afraid of anyone, for judgment belongs to God. Bring me any case too hard for you, and I will hear it. And at that time I told you everything you were to do. So this is a parallel account, which tells us some interesting stuff. One, it tells us that the people themselves actually had a role to play in selecting the administrative helpers, which I find very interesting. It's kind of ratified by Moses, I would assume ratified by God, but the people picked out the leaders themselves. Interesting, very interesting to me. Now, there's not much detail given on what judges or officials would actually do or not do. There's no instruction about what's the extent of their authority. There's no guidance on how would we address incompetence, or conflict of interest or corruption or whatever. Well, actually, it does deal with corruption, so I should have left that one out. But God, through his word, focuses on ethics, rather than the structure. That's what's important. What's driving you? What's driving these people? Why are they doing what they're doing? Yes, we want to also talk about what they're doing. But both those things are more important than the structure. And the structure might change in the future. We just saw it changed. And guess what? It's going to change again. It's going to change again. Now, this version adds to Jethro's advice. Jethro advised qualifications, which we just read through, wise, capable, smart people. And to this, we've had some very interesting and godly things added. What's added? Fairness. They must judge with fairness. Equity. Non-discrimination. No partiality. No partiality based on wealth. No fear of a public opinion. Very important standards of godly governance. Not mentioned by the pagan priest, Jethro. But added. These are timeless. These are God's imperative, like what God sees as real important stuff. And you'll see the same principles repeated in the New Testament when you look at the qualifications listed for leadership in the Church of God. For example, in 1 Timothy chapter 3. They're not word for word, but it's similar principles, And these qualities, you think about the church, and finding leaders who've got all these qualities, good luck. Sorry to say it, but good luck finding someone who fits the bill 100%. These qualities take a lifetime to fully learn. You are learning them now. And I think that the best we can hope for is that within the church, leaders have at least made a good start down that path and that they are dedicated to staying on that path. All right, now, I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about some things, and one of them is this word theocracy. Was Israel a theocracy? Because sometimes you'll hear people say, you guys, and you talk about the Old Testament and God this and God that, and that's a theocracy. We don't want a theocracy. We don't want a bunch of priests running the show. No! Well, I'm going to ask a question. Was Israel really a theocracy? She's better looking than me, but I could do the same face. Huh? Because I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball here. Go to Deuteronomy 16. I'm going to just walk through some stuff. Chapter 16, verse 18 is talking about what the folks were expected to do when they gathered together in Jerusalem each year. I think this is meant to happen around the Feast of Tabernacles. Everybody's there. And it says at that time, basically, verse 18, appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the innocent. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God is giving you. Okay, notice the words judges and officials, not priests. And I think what we're seeing here are some, what I'm going to call classic branches of government, human government. I hope everybody took some form of civics when you were in school and you learned a little bit about the different branches of government. We have this kind of a system in the United States. We have it in Western democracies as a whole. You've got different branches. Well, here you've got judges, right? The judicial branch, okay? Those who make binding decisions about cases based on the law. They had the guidance of God's, the examples that God gave, like right after the commandments, there's like three chapters of case law. All right, here's how you take these rules and here's how you apply them. You know, when Douglas has a cow and it eats all the grass in Mr. Smith's field, what do you do about it? That's the kind of stuff that the judgments and statutes are there to give precedent, to give procedural concepts, and the judges were supposed to do that. How do we apply this law? So you've got the judicial, then you've got the officials. The executive branch, if you will. We have that in the United States, right? The officials who see that the decisions of the law are applied and enforced. The executive is not supposed to be making the laws. Now, in the United States, we seem to be blurring the lines, but the executive is there to execute, to do the law, not to make the law. We have judges, we have officials. Now, in the United States, we have a legislative branch, which is the Congress, right? I hope you know that from civics. So their job is to make the laws. Israel does not have a legislative branch of government. Why is that? Well, it's because the laws come directly from God. Good laws, the proper laws, do not come about by voting on them. The laws come directly from God. However, you know, they would develop a body of case law based on the examples that God had provided, like I mentioned earlier. And, you know, we use that same kind of a system in the United States where we have laws and then there's case law that's built up. You know, you see these lawyers with all their books on the shelf. Those are all the case laws. You've heard, you know, you've probably watched some dumb show like Suits or something like that. Well, you know, the precedent was established in Murphy versus Murphy. And that's case law. That's what we use. They don't use that in Europe. We use that here. It's also used in England. These are not priests. These are not priests. A priest isn't a part of this whole thing. Priests, what do priests do? Well, priests provided moral instruction based on law, and they administered the holy things related to the temple. That's what priests did. So I put it to you that Israel, well, Israel wasn't really a theocracy. That's kind of a popular misconception. The priests didn't run everything. No. Now, through judges and officials and stuff like that, God acknowledges the practicality of these various functions. You know, a judicial branch, an executive branch. And there's a priest branch. They do their priest thing. But he doesn't dictate their structure. He doesn't say a whole lot about the structure. They're there. But his emphasis is on the importance of righteous character, impartiality, avoidance of covetousness, big stuff like that. How you organize yourself, that's small potatoes. What's important are these things that God emphasizes. Now, when you start looking at the history of Israel, as we move on through the history, there are some periods that lasted centuries where you've got elders and you've got judges. So let's look at elders and judges first by going to Numbers chapter 11, verse 14 through 17. It says, very similar to what we've read before, Moses says, I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. And then he says, he's speaking to God, if this is how you're going to treat me, God, this is, I can't handle it. The stress is killing me. If this is how you're going to treat me, please go ahead and kill me. You know, shoot me now. He's under a lot of stress. If I have found favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin. He's under a lot of stress. And the Lord said to Moses, bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people, and have them come to the tent of meeting that I may stand there with you, and I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take some of the power of the Spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they will share the burden of the people with you. so that you will not have to carry it alone. So God engages with this appointment of elders. They're not just doing it all on their own with God not being really involved. You know, God's just off somewhere smoking a pipe and thinking big thoughts about ethics. No, God is engaged. God is engaged. He is engaged in the appointment of the elders to assist in leading the people. He gives them a measure of his spirit, which Moses had. And we don't know a lot about, you know, exactly how they were selected or how they functioned, as I've mentioned before. But elders are a presence. God acknowledges them and he works with them in Israel. And they were there actually even before Moses came on the scene. If you go back to Exodus 3, verse 16, you know, Moses is, he's off in the desert 40 years, and he comes back after the burning bush. He comes back to Egypt, and he's got this message from Yahweh, of the I Am, you know, and God says, speak to the people. Well, who does he talk to? When he goes back to Egypt, who does he talk to? Look it up in Exodus 3, verse 16, verse 18 as well. He talks to the elders. So there were elders in Israel. You know, at that time, they were kind of disorganized, but there were elders, and there were probably just the heads of extended households, tribal leadership. And so, you know, there we see that God is working and using with an already established order. It was already there. And God's working with what's already there. What makes the elders function properly, or hopefully properly, is God endorsing it and giving them his spirit, which is going to open up a lot of other things, hopefully point them in the right direction, ethically, morally, and so forth. And he did this for a very long time, centuries. He was just, he's working with a very established order. The elder model was, you know, the leadership model throughout the days of Moses. They had Moses there, of course, but they were elders. And the elders continued. They continued to be part of the whole governing structure in Israel throughout the days of Joshua. And they continued on as leadership even after Joshua's death. Go with me to Joshua 24, verse 31. Book we hardly ever go to. But in Joshua 24, verse 31, it says, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. So here are the elders, even in the time Moses is gone, the elders are still around. Joshua dies, the elders continue on. But it's a kind of a weak system. It's a weak system. And it carries on. If you flip over to Judges chapter 8, this is centuries later, time of Gideon here, in Judges 8, verse 13 through 16, it says, all right, Gideon, it's the time of the judges, they're in the land, hundreds of years have passed by. Gideon, son of Joash, then returned from the battle by the pass of Heres, and he caught a young man of Succoth, and he questioned him, and the young man wrote down for him the names of the 77 officials of Succoth, the elders of the town. Then Gideon came and he said to the men of Succoth, here are Zebah and Zebulah, about whom you have taunted me by saying, do you already have them? So he's talking and dealing with the elders. You can also look at Judges 11, 4 through verse 11. Chapter 11, verse 4 through 11. This is the time of Jephthah. And Jephthah, I hope you might know the story of Jephthah, I hope you do, but when Jephthah is dealing with the people, he's dealing through the elders. The elders are still a presence in Israel after centuries and centuries and centuries. So we're in Judges. So there's this next section where we've got to consider these judges, okay? And things kind of got out of control with the elders. It was a very weak form of leadership, and the people got themselves into all kinds of trouble. And this period of judges comes upon us, the book of Judges, and it lasts for about 400 years. And elders, you know, they were a weak, dispersed leadership. And in times of crisis, God would raise up a strong leader called a judge. But it's really, if you look at the word, it means a deliverer. Okay? A deliverer. And these deliverers were sort of a combination of judicial, executive, and spiritual leadership. And so they did it all. And I think they best line up with what we nowadays would call a benevolent dictatorship. That's what I think. Now, the last and the greatest of these deliverers was Samuel. And we went through, we read about Samuel. We read 1 and 2 Samuel. Samuel was great. His son's not so great. The other problems in the country were people were kind of looking around. They were kind of alarmed at the corruption that they saw on the lower levels of administration. And so they said, we want a king. When they were saying, we want a king, what were they doing? They were looking at all the governing structures around them. They're looking at the nations around and said, well, we want that. They were looking, we want that already established system here in Israel. So they asked for a king. And they wanted to deal with this corruption. And they also wanted the security of a more permanent military presence. You know, that's what kings are really all about. Military. And taxes. And they demand a change to the governing structure. Right. They wanted a military king, which was the dominant governing structure of the nations around them. All right, so that takes us to the next section, kings, and then prophets, governors, and others. Okay, so God agreed to their request. They asked for a king, God agreed, but he gave them some warnings. Let's read 1 Samuel when it happens. 1 Samuel 8, verse 9. And he says this in verse 9. All right. Now listen. Okay, listen to these people, Samuel. All right. They want a king. Okay, we're going to do this. But warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. And when people have power, they demand certain things. And so the rest of the chapter talks about all the stuff that the king would claim as his rights. What are his rights? Well, first thing a king wants is unchecked access to your money and your land. And they want access to your women. And they're going to want military conscription. That's what God warns them about. And that's the model of all the nations around them. God says, you're going to be careful about this stuff. And, you know, those are the big areas that humanity gets themselves into trouble with, you know, sex, money, and power. That's the source of most of our troubles. All right, this actually is sort of a repeat of a warning that was already delivered to them before they even asked, going back to Deuteronomy 17. We're going to go there. It's going to draw out some interesting things that we didn't read. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14 through 20 says this. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, and you take in possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us, like all the nations around us. Be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the Levite priests. And it is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then, and you know, if he does these things, he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. So this is where the original warning is from. And it emphasizes what? It emphasizes the character needed to be king. And one of the things that I think is specific, very interesting, is he is not to consider himself better And we'll see that when Jesus starts teaching a bit about leadership, humility, service. But it also talks about things the king, you know, was to avoid. Well, faith in God, not guns, basically. What he's getting at, you know, the horses, the chariots. Don't go to Egypt and you know, try and buy a whole bunch of military supplies. Have your faith in God, not guns. Avoid sexual shenanigans, you know. It's going to get you into trouble. Avoid covetousness. Very basic spiritual concepts. Knowledge of God's law. And again, he is not to consider himself better than the rest, which I think implies a whole gamut of equity, justice, and fairness. Now, the only way a monarchical system, a king system, would ever work, I mean, really, or any structure would ever work, is if the ethical imperatives that God lays out are observed. It's the only way any system ever works. The system is not the answer. The monarchies that followed in Israel, we read through them, we went through Samuel and Kings, they were awful. The monarchies in both Judah and Israel were administrative and procedural disasters. When they stuck to the ethical guidance God provided, which was very rare, but when they stuck to it, things went well. When they got away from it, things went very badly. Badly, badly, worse, worse, until the point where they were basically overwhelmed and subjugated by foreign powers, like the Assyrians, followed by the Babylonians, then Persia, then the Greeks. And that takes us to the next section after the kings, because their nation, it's gone. They lose it because they don't hold on to the ethical principles. The structure doesn't save them. The military king can't provide for them. He can't protect them. No. They fall. Now they're a subject people. There's a time of transition and turmoil. All right? This is more change. The king thing is gone. God's people will now be under a different kind of government structure. King thing, it's over. The people of God would now have to work with new structures, and they would continue to change. They would not be any less the people of God because of the change in the governing structure, because there was no longer a king. No, that didn't make a difference. They were still the people of God, but the thing that keeps them the people of God are the things that don't change. The ethical and moral demands, those still remained. But how are they going to play out in this new scenario? All right. So while they're captives to a foreign power, the main social leaders in Israel seem to be, well, you've got priests like Ezra, so you do have priests. But at the same time as Ezra, there were also governors, right, who represented the people before the kings and the imperial court. You've got people like Nehemiah, he was not a priest. You've got Zerubbabel, Daniel, they're not priests, they're officials operating within this imperial structure. So it's still not a theocratic setup. At the same time, there were prophets in the land. There were men like Ezekiel, Habakkuk, Haggai, Zephaniah. But these prophets did not administer executive or judicial power. That was not their role. Their role was to speak truth to power, okay? To offer spiritual correction, to exhort the people if God had a thing he wanted them to do. And, you know, the prophets often speak to the community leaders, you know. But we don't know who the leaders were. Maybe they went back to the elder system. Maybe they were the governors. It's probably a mix of both. So structurally, it was kind of a mess. Very confused, somewhat chaotic kind of a setup. Now, Judah did regain power again, and set up a kingdom at the time of the Maccabees. This would be after the Greeks dominated them, but before the Romans came along and just shut everything back down again. So for about a century, they had a monarch again, the Maccabees, but it lasted a very, very short time. So that takes us up to the time of the Romans. So what's the situation when Jesus appears, when Jesus comes on the scene? I told you we go right up to the the church. So we're going to talk about what was it like when Jesus showed up? What kind of governing structure did he see? Okay, well, under the Romans, the Romans basically ran everything, but there was a governing body called the Sanhedrin. You've heard of that. We talk about it usually around Passover because they're very involved in the Passover sequence. There's this Sanhedrin, and it develops over time under the Roman rule. And the Sanhedrin was there as part of Jewish leadership until the destruction of the temple around 70 AD. Okay? And the Sanhedrin had limited judicial and executive power. Remember, when they wanted to kill Jesus, they couldn't do it themselves. They had to go to the Romans. They didn't have the authority to do that. Right? They basically were responsible for Jewish stuff that the Romans didn't care about. Again, I'm going to bring this up. The Sanhedrin was not a collection of priests. There were priests on the Sanhedrin, but they were not all priests. Nicodemus was not a priest. When Jesus came on the scene, he had to interact with a very complicated governing structure. He had to interact with two very different forms of governance. There were the Jewish authorities on one hand, and they kind of governed traditional society and how we do things as Jews and so forth. And then on the other hand, he had Rome. And Rome, their focus was on taxation, on military power, and the police. That's what the Romans were all about, mostly taxation. Now, through all this, in this very complex matrix of authority and governance, Jesus is consistent in his teaching, which is he taught submission to both governments, the Jewish and the Roman, unless it conflicted with God's law. That was Jesus' teaching. And when Jesus starts teaching about stuff like this, he's teaching about governance. And he's actually teaching you and me about governance, because to learn governance, to be ready to be seated with Christ in places of heavenly ordained authority, you have to learn to govern. But to learn to govern, you first have to learn to be governed, right? If you're going to be a good governor, you have to know what it's like to have someone telling you what to do all the time. So you're not a jerk, to put it, bluntly. You learn to be governed. And that's a tough lesson, but it's part of learning to govern later. And Jesus was in a situation where they were governed. God's people were governed by people who were not godly. So let's look at some of the stuff that Jesus talked about in Matthew 22. We'll go there first. So one of the things, this is a very well-known scripture, Matthew 22, this is the coin of Caesar. Matthew 22, they show him a coin. Should we pay taxes to the Romans? Should we submit to the Roman rule? Should we rebel? And he looks at the coin and he says, okay, whose picture's on this coin? And they say, that's Caesar's picture. And then he says, Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. So he's teaching people to pay taxes to the Romans, submitting to the governing authority there. Now go to Matthew 17, verse 24. Here it says, after Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter, and they asked, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Well, yes, he does, he replied. And this was Jesus' teaching. He taught them to submit to the authority of the Jewish temple authorities. Both systems of government needed to go along with them, because governing is God's way. And this is what Jesus taught. If you think about him healing the lepers, when he healed them, where did he send them? He sent them to the priests. Work with the people in positions of authority. Go to the priests. Go through the Leviticus routine when you're healed of leprosy. He taught people to be subject to their rulers, even when the rulers were no good. when they were corrupt. Go back to Matthew 23, look at verse 2. And he told them to support the priests and the religious teachers, even when they were kind of corrupt. Matthew 23, verse 2 says, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, they sit in Moses' seat." They put themselves forward as this, you know, the big man. "So you must be careful to do everything that they tell you, according to the law, but not to do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." Verse 23, he is talking about the hypocrisy, and he says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law, Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. So you should focus on the big issues, but don't let the little ones slide." So he's teaching, okay, You got to work with the people who are teachers, appointed as teachers. You got to continue tithing. You got to submit to these legal authorities, even though they're really kind of, they're no good. All right, it's a system of governance there. It's not a good one. Not a good one. No way. Throughout his ministry, Jesus never disparaged the Sanhedrin as a governing body. He never said, "Well, you know, things would be so much better if we just got rid of the Sanhedrin," or, "You know, the Sanhedrin needs to be cleaned up. We need to get rid of all these bad guys and we need to replace them all with good guys. Hey, maybe you disciples would be," you know. No, that's not what Jesus ever said. He never disparaged the Sanhedrin as a governing body, but he showed himself to be subject to it, even unto death. On the other hand, he also never advocated or endorsed any specific form of government. "You know, things would be better around here if we just changed the way we did stuff." No, he didn't do that either. Mm-hmm. He did give some powerful and pointed instruction about leadership, though. You know, we often go to the section right before the Passover where he hears the disciples arguing about who's greatest in the kingdom or will be greatest in the kingdom, and he says, "You know, look, you guys got it all wrong. You know, the Gentiles focus on stuff like that, who's going to be in charge and who's going to lord it over others. But it's not going to, it should not be that way with you. The servant will be the greatest," right? That's what he's teaching about leadership. So we've heard all this stuff in the Old Testament: honesty, integrity, not being covetousness. And Jesus adds some new stuff about leadership. He adds some important spiritual perspectives on leadership, like humility, service. That's what he's talking about with the disciples when he's talking to them about, "Do not be like the Gentiles." Humility, service. The fruits of the Spirit are meant to be applied to leadership. And so he adds on to all the things that are said with these additional teachings. And these instructions are matters of ethics and character rather than structure. Jesus didn't come along and say, "You know, we could fix this all if we just change the way we organize stuff." No, Jesus wants to change you. People. All right, so we've covered a lot of territory. Centuries, millennia. What can we learn from these Old Testament examples? Well, here is what I want to leave you thinking. The way that we organize and govern ourselves changes. It just does. Even as the people of God, there is no single organizational pattern that you can point to and say, "You know what? This is God's form of government." You can't do that unless you're talking about moral, ethical, and spiritual values. That's what makes good government. Now here locally, as I mentioned earlier, you are about to experience a change in how your congregations are managed. It's a coming. Things are going to change. But what doesn't change are the matters of character, the ethics, why we do what we do, fairness, respect, and justice. Things like that never change. Humility, service, they never change. That doesn't change at all, ever. In God's church, we emphasize that your present purpose, your calling as first fruits, is to learn and to develop in yourself the principles of godly governance. And to do that, a big part of it is learning to be governed. And you learn godly governance so that you are prepared to be seated alongside Christ as kings and priests, you know, the executive, the judiciary, the teachers in the world to come. Your training for governing, training for leadership, does not involve an apprenticeship in today's worldly governance. Oh, the way to learn leadership, well, I should run for Congress. No, that's not God's program. That's not how you learn leadership, not how you learn governance. Now, most of your present training concerns being governed, learning to be governed, as I mentioned, so that you know what it feels like to be governed. I think that you reflect on that, it will change the way you would govern. And that's the biggest part of what you and I are learning now. Okay, some will experience a position of authority in the governing structure of the Church of God. But not most people. Most people don't. Some will learn through governing their own family, their children, their family. Some won't. A lot of learning is about learning to be governed. What you're learning and what you're practicing is a way of thinking that leads to godly governance, regardless of how things are organized. I think the kingdom will be very organized, but that's not what makes it work. And this is the essence of Jesus' teachings about authority, governance, and leadership. To focus on the person that you are, rather than putting confidence in the structure that you are a part of. Focus on humility and service, justice, integrity, honesty, mercy, gentleness, and a whole lot more.